Joining me here in the studio to discuss these very important issues, Dr. Jonathan Speier, Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Global Research and International Affairs in Herzliya, Israel. Dr. Speier, good afternoon.
Hello, Tom.
Now, should I be surprised that America and Iran appear to be cooperating to try and wipe out the Islamic State?
Well, you may well be surprised, sure, because, of course, America and Iran have been involved in a very central rivalry in the Middle East over recent years. At the same time, ISIS, as a Sunni Islamist, jihadi organization, is in a certain sense a natural enemy for both parties. But yes, it is surprising, and to some degree, the extent to which the Americans seem to be okay with being on the same side as the Iranians right now, Secretary Kerry, saying that as far as he's concerned, the Iranian airstrikes were just fine, it does represent a strange new development in the Middle East.
Is this just a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Well, it is. That's the core of it, I would say. But I would also say that it says something to the willingness of this U.S. administration not to regard the Iranians as an enemy, or their desire to kind of bring the Iranians in from the cold. And I would say, in a certain sense, I would have to say also to ignore some of the bad stuff that the Iranians are doing, because on the ground in Iraq right now, the Iranians are there, the Revolutionary Guards are there, and they're helping those Shia militias who are fighting against ISIS. But the Shia militias, in many ways, are by no means the superiors of ISIS. Mm. Often they're just as cruel and just as, committing violations just as much as ISIS are.
Okay, now let's shift to ISIS. I mean, Australia has a small number of forces there. I think a couple hundred special forces and six or eight aircraft. Mm-hmm. America's got a bigger commitment. Is it successful? And I only ask this because up until a month or so ago, we were getting, gruesome videos of beheadings, mm-hmm. People waving the black and white flag. I mean, we got the impression that Baghdad was about to be overrun. That doesn't appear to have happened. What is going on the ground there?
Yeah, I do think that the Western airstrikes, the US airstrikes, have been successful, actually, in the limited goal of stopping the headlong advance of Islamic State forces, which you correctly, noted, which was taking place back in the summer, back in August. Yeah, then the airstrikes were committed in order to stop that advance, and they have largely succeeded in doing so. IS is no longer sweeping eastwards towards, or southwards towards Baghdad, or eastwards towards the oil fields. It's been stopped in its track. It's not yet begun to seriously be pushed back, but it has stopped advancing.
Okay, so not pushed back, but it isn't pushing forward. Mm-hmm. Now, what about disturbing reports I've read, which suggests that many units in the Iraqi army are phantom. That is, people join up and then they agree to split their pay with their commanding officer and they don't actually have to fight. So the government's paying for, I read, 50,000 soldiers who don't actually exist. So we've got Western troops there doing a job that arguably Iraqi troops should do. And yet a lot of those Iraqi troops either don't want to fight, don't actually exist, or have done a financial arrangement so they don't have to fight. I mean, should we be try to prop up such an army?
I think that's actually a very good question. First of all, you're quite right in your characterization of the Iraqi army. And of course, we saw when ISIS swept into Mosul City, one of the largest cities in Iraq, at the beginning of their offensive in August, that the Iraqi garrison simply fell apart. And that is because of the widespread corruption in the Iraqi security forces, which is now becoming apparent. As to whether we should be propping it up, my own view is no. We need to be taking a good look at exactly what Iraq is and who this government is. But I do think there was a duty to do what was done in August to stop the ISIS advance. Because if ISIS had taken Erbil City in northern Iraq, for example, there very probably would have been something approaching genocide, nothing less than that. Literally tens of thousands would have lost their lives. So it was necessary to act to prevent that. And I think it's good that the West did so.
Now, recently, you've actually been on the ground in Syria. That's a civil war that is now, I believe, must be in its fourth year or coming up to it very soon.
That is correct.
What is happening? I mean, is there any resolution in sight? And how bad is it?
There's no resolution in sight, and it's very, very bad indeed. More than 200,000 people have lost their lives in that war now, in the over 3 years now of civil war in Syria. And the sad thing is that the lines are not moving. That's to say, Syria is effectively now split up, de facto partitioned into a number of different zones of control: the regime, the rebels, ISIS, and also the Kurdish forces. And the lines aren't really moving, but people are still dying. The fighting is still taking place. The regime is still bombing civilian areas. The rebels are still trying to fight back. And there's no resolution in sight because no one side is anywhere near strong enough to beat the others and bring the thing to a decision.
Do you think maybe a solution just is that Syria sort of becomes partitioned between the various groups? So you've got a rump of the old government that survives. You've got ISIS-type forces in one corner. You've got the Free Syrian army in another? I mean, is it possible the country just gets divided up?
To some degree, I think that's probably, you know, what may well happen. Right now, that's the factual situation on the ground. And we have to kind of ask ourselves, well, what's the thing that's going to put Humpty together again, so to speak, right now? It's very hard to imagine what force could. So I think we've seen in the past, also in post-communist Europe, the situation in which a country just falls apart and ends up, the new borders end up being decided on de facto lines, that this is where the forces have fought one another to a standstill. But right now in Syria, the fact is that the forces don't feel they've fought each other to a standstill yet anytime soon. They're still fighting. Each one still wants to win, but none of them are anything like strong enough to do so.
We're speaking to Dr. Jonathan Spire. He's an expert in Middle Eastern affairs. Now, what about petrol prices? I mean, for a lot of us here, you know, what happens in the Middle East is sort of a long way away. People do question, I think rightly so, why we are involved. I mean, Australia does not have any direct interest in that area, but normally when we have conflict in the Middle East, we see the oil price going up through the roof. I remember when, Iraq invaded Kuwait back in 1990, you know, petrol prices doubled almost overnight. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened this time. I mean, if anything, the price of oil is at, I think, 4 or 5 year lows at the moment.
Yes, that's correct.
Why is that? What's going on?
This is related, as far as we can see, to a Saudi attempt to keep oil prices low. And this is part of the competition between the Saudis, or the fear that the Saudis have with regard to US and Canadian shale oil. They want to bring keep prices down to a level where it no longer becomes profitable to develop shale oil wells in North America. So this is about a kind of oil price war and a Saudi attempt to head off competition.
Are the Saudis financing ISIS, though, or IS?
As a government, the Saudis are not financing IS. In fact, they're quite frightened of the possibility of jihadis coming home and being against the Saudi government. But I think IS money is largely coming, however, from the Gulf, largely from private sources. There are a whole lot of private, very, very wealthy individuals in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar also, who support the goals of IS, and the money appears to be coming from them, but also from IS's own economic activities, including smuggling, including contraband oil going into Turkey, including trade in antiquities and a whole bunch of other stuff that they get up to.
What about this issue of young Western men? We've seen it here in Australia. Britain has a real problem. France has a problem. America, interestingly, less so. But, I mean, men of Middle Eastern background, most of whom have either born here or brought up here, we would have thought with Australian values, and yet somehow they get radicalised, as the phrase is, and suddenly they've turned up in Syria, in Turkey, in Iraq, and they're fighting for the other side. Why is that happening?
I do think, my sense is that this is the visible tip of a much larger iceberg, the visible and most extreme tip of a much larger iceberg, frankly, which is that there has been a failure in the UK, in France, in some Scandinavian countries, too, in Australia. Perhaps also there appears to have been a failure to successfully integrate a large number of second generation, usually native born, you know, Muslim sons or daughters of immigrants who just do not seem to have the core values and loyalties to the countries in question. And there's been a very major failure in that regard. And those Muslim communities, also their leaders, don't appear to have given them those values. So the most extreme among them today are attracted to Islamic State.
But is there anything we can do?
I think there's a number of things. First of all, there's a coercive element, I would say, in terms of the fact that my view, at least, is when those people come back, if they come back, then the full force of the law should be used against them.
Well, the government has made that clear, but a lot of them have torn up their passports and said, we're never coming back. Well, it's, you know, death before dishonour or something like that.
How can I put it? If they don't come back, I wouldn't regard those people as being any huge and great loss to Australia or any other country they belong to. But part of it, I think, is, you know, using the full force of the law. But the other part is also understanding where some of this comes from and making sure through a process of education and de-radicalization, you know, that the local values manage to penetrate into some of these very close communities.
But it's easy to say de-radicalize, you know, they become radicalized, we de-radicalize and we fix it. But I mean, you know, how do you stop an imam who in another language in a Western Sydney mosque, you know, tells young men that they've got to fight jihad against the great Satan? I mean, what can we do about that?
Well, I think one of the issues also is that of political asylum. Many of these imams, you know, many of these radical preachers have found their way into Western countries in residence because they've been given status as political refugees. Many of them were, you know, oppositionists back home. There needs to be a very close look at that policy and whether it's the right thing to be allowing these guys into the country to then seek to poison the minds of another generation of locally grown young Muslims.
Well, that is a question for another time. It's been great having you in here, Dr. Jonathan Spire from the Centre for Global Research and International Affairs in Herzliya in Israel. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Tom.